The people living in the times of the Navi Yechezkel once approached him with the following question. With idolatry rampant and the Beis HaMikdash destroyed and Judaism looking increasingly less glamorous, they wanted to know if they were to walk away from it all and just assimilate into the world around them, would that make them not Jewish? Did their Jewishness depend on their conscious decision to follow it, or was it ingrained in them whether they liked it or not? They asked this question because they wanted out. They were ready to leave, but they wanted to know if walking away would absolve them from the obligation to keep the Torah. Would they still get punished for not shaking the lulav or eating pork? Would their decision to leave rid them of all their religious responsibilities? So we all know the answer to this question. To us, it seems simple, but is it really? In essence, they were asking Yechezkel a fundamental question about Judaism. Every other religion in the world is intellectually based. If you decide to be Muslim, then you're Muslim. If you decide to be Christian, you're Christian. If you decide to be a Hindu, you're a Hindu. If you decide to be Buddhist, then you're a Buddhist. If you intellectually subscribe to that religion, then you're a part of it. And if you make a conscious decision to break off, then you're not. Is that true with Judaism? And if it isn't true, why not? These people reasoned with Yechezkel, saying, when our ancestors stood at Har Sinai, they chose Judaism. We didn't. Why are we bound to a choice that they made? If our grandparents chose to become vegetarians, that wouldn't automatically make us vegetarians. So why should the choice my ancestors made to accept upon themselves the yoke of Torah be binding on us? They intellectually chose to accept it. Why can't we intellectually reject it? This same question was posed by the Jews of Spain to the great 15th century sage Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, the author of the Akedas Yitzchak. These frightened Jews, faced with the horrific choice of converting to Christianity or dying, asked him if conversion to Christianity absolves them from their religious duties. They told him, our grandparents chose Judaism, but now, under our current conditions, we feel like we must choose Christianity. It's just too hard. Perhaps if our grandparents knew how hard it would turn out to be, they wouldn't have accepted Judaism on our behalf. Can we shed our Jewishness? That was their question to the Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama. So the Navi Yechezkel and Rabbi Yitzchak Arama turned to their respective communities and responded essentially the same way. Both pointed out the fundamental mistake that the people were making. Our ancestors didn't choose Judaism and then forcefully bequeath it to us. It is not an intellectual concept that can be abandoned at will. One does not become non-Jewish if he sheds the philosophy of Judaism in order to get baptized or convert to Islam. We don't receive Judaism from our parents. Every single one of us stood at Har Sinai and willingly accepted the Torah and Hashem's kingship. This wasn't an intellectual acknowledgement. It was a transformation. The animalistic instincts bottled up inside of us, the grotesque beast lurking underneath our skin, which we developed in Egypt, was effectively eradicated by the blast of spirituality that we got on Har Sinai. We got an injection of holiness that instantly elevated us to become Hashem's ambassadors on the country called Earth. It was not an intellectual idea. It was not conceptual. It was not a mental agreement. It was Hashem granting us the exclusive access to the elixir of life, the holy and sacred Torah that literally went into our bloodstreams. The human body is comprised of 248 limbs and 365 ligaments and sinews. There are 248 positive mitzvahs in the Torah and 365 negative ones. Is that a coincidence? Of course not. It is precisely due to the fact that when we received the Torah, the 613 mitzvahs became infused into our every single one of our 613 parts of our body. It instantly raised us above humanity. It instantly charged us with a mission of cherishing that holiness and bringing it wherever our feet take us. Our very DNA became supercharged with godliness. Going into a Christian Baptist bath aligning with the Islamic faith, doing yoga with a bunch of Buddhists on a mountain in Nepal cannot surgically remove the holiness embedded inside of us. It cannot take away our Judaism, for Judaism is our essence. Our very cells are Jewish. And this holiness came with immediate ramifications. We no longer could act the same way others did. What was morally acceptable for others was no longer morally acceptable for us. Our holy bodies require different food to fuel it. Hence, a Jew is prohibited to eat certain foods, notwithstanding the fact that those foods don't seem to affect non-Jews at all. It's because our supremely holy bodies are physically supercharged with sanctity and must be treated as such. This reality has proven itself over the course of human history. Thousands of various religions have been tried by the world since its inception. Virtually only Judaism has endured, for it is not an idea that can fly away with the intellectual winds of the times. It is not a religious trend that gets outdated or archaic. It is a physical force embedded in the body of a Jew, and it gets passed down to the next generation, whether or not that generation is even aware of its existence. The holiness is inherent. It is a spark of the divine. Those sparks can sit dormant for thousands of years, but they will come to the surface at some point by a Jew who feels their cries and allow them to glow again. Jews who know nothing about Judaism still seem to hang on to something, a Pesach Seder, a Yom Kippur, a yardside candle, a Yizkor. Jews who oppose Judaism, Jews who have been irreligious for centuries still have that spark inside of them, and sometimes, without even realizing it, they refuse to let that spark go. There was once a frantic knock on the door of the Chafetz Chaim's home, and the Chafetz Chaim opened it to find a soldier in the Russian army staring at him. So the Chafetz Chaim ushered him in and he asked him, "What can I do for you?" The burly soldier sat down and began crying uncontrollably. So the Chafetz Chaim, a bit surprised, he asked the man what was wrong. The soldier looked into the Chafetz Chaim's eyes and told him the following. He said, "You may think I'm a regular Russian soldier, but I'm not. My name is Yitzchak Yarkovsky, and I'm a Jew. I was grabbed by the Russian army when I was 5, and I haven't done a single Jewish thing since. Every day I think about Judaism. Every day I long to be back. Every day I feel something inside of me, but what can I do? The Russian army is a brutal place for any human to be in, let alone an innocent Jewish boy, so holy sage. I'm going to have to go back to my camp in a few minutes. Can you give me some words of inspiration? What will become of my Jewishness? Am I still a Jew? What will become of my children?" The Chafetz Chaim looked at the poor fellow and he told him the following. He said, "Every Jew has a soul inside of him that permeates his very essence with holiness. No force, no ideology, no army, no union, no revolution can ever take that away from him. The Jewish soul is bulletproof. Walk with your head held high, knowing that every cell in your body is different. You may not know the intricacies of Judaism, but if you keep up the courage to tap into your soul's infinite holiness, its presence will be felt forever, and it will one day be rekindled." In this parsha, when Moshe told the Jewish people that they're all standing at that mountain making a covenant with Hashem, he wasn't talking about a business deal in which one side could hire a really expensive lawyer and get rid of the whole agreement. He was talking about a metamorphosis of holiness. He wasn't just talking to the people physically standing there. He was talking to every future soul in the Jewish people's galaxy. Har Sinai dispensed holiness into the souls of Jews for every time and for every era, from the holiest sage learning on a hilltop in Tveria to a soldier in the barracks of the Russian army. The Jewish people seem to have a little obsession with water. We wake up in the morning, we wash our hands. We walk at the shul, we wash our hands. We go out of a bathroom, we wash our hands. We sit down and eat a piece of bread, we wash our hands. We dip any food into a liquid, we wash our hands. We touch our shoes, scratch our head, wash our hands. We run to immerse into a mikvah, some people go a month, yearly, monthly, daily. We are forever dealing with water. You ever wonder, what does pouring water over our hands accomplish? What does immersing in water do? So the Mishnah Berurah, in his second explanation to the halacha of Netilas Yadayim in Siman Kuf Nun Ches, Sivkatan Aleph writes that if we wash, when we wash our hands, we do so because we are charged with being holy. By pouring water over our hands, we internalize the idea of being holy. Now let me ask you, what does pouring water over our hands have to do with being holy? What does washing our hands after we scratch our heads or touch our shoes have to do with sanctity? It isn't merely for cleanliness, because we are obligated to wash our hands even if they're not noticeably dirty. So why are we doing it? The answer lies in the translation of the word netilas. The word netel, according to Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, means to raise. By pouring water over our hands, we signify to ourselves that we are different. We are higher. We raise ourselves up. We are holier than the animalistic, lustful world we live in. We pour water on our hands because water is different. Water represents a place where the typical human can't be. It's a place where the ordinary human can't survive. And yet that's where we are. We live above humanity. We carve out a little island of holiness in this earthly tsunami we live in and forever make that our residence. We walk around feeling the charge of Kedusha we received at Har Sinai. We never tell ourselves that the Torah wasn't speaking to us. We don't say, that was then and this is now. Every single one of us was at Har Sinai. The holiness was given to all of us, to the Jew in Granada in 1129, to the Jew in Tunisia in 1255, to the Jew in Turkey in 1584, to the Jew in Uzbekistan in 1837, to the Jew in the Lower East Side in 1919, and to the Jew listening to this right now in Los Angeles and Toronto and Miami and Baltimore. The Torah spoke to us all. It injected our souls with the perfect amount of Kedusha to enable us to take on any challenge we face, no matter what time, no matter what place. It's not an ideology we inherited. It's not a physical force we were born with. It's that spark that enabled us to look away when our Spanish neighbors idolized bullfighting and the torture of animals. It's a spark that made us abhor the gladiator fights that the Roman society so immensely loved. It's the spark that keeps us morally sound in a Western world drowning in immorality. It's the spark that makes a Jew a Jew. Towards the end of the Second World War, a mysterious German submarine crossed the Atlantic Ocean and shockingly made it all the way to American shores. It promptly opened up its doors and six shadowy spies got out of the submarine and ran inland. These six men were tasked with planting bombs at different locations throughout America in an effort to sabotage the American army in its war with Germany. Five of the men ran off without being seen, but the last one was spotted while running on a nearby dock by a local fisherman, and that man raced to the police to report it. And after describing roughly what the man looked like, the police forwarded the case to the FBI, who began a frantic search to catch this man. My wife's great-grandfather, Shmuel Hopfer, a German immigrant, was a big tzaddik, a big Talmud Chacham, and he was also a brilliant inventor and a professor at the prestigious Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And despite having lived in America for years before the war broke out, he was nevertheless suspected by the FBI as being that last spy that ran off the submarine. So they began tracking his every move. And one day after he left his house in Ithaca, the FBI broke into his house to investigate. And what they found shocked them. They found something that should not have been there. They found something that left them with the unequivocal conclusion that Shmuel Hopfer was, in fact, a German spy. What did they find? In the bedroom, lying in plain sight, was none other than a shaitel. Now, who would possibly wear a wig but a spy trying to disguise himself, they thought to themselves. He was promptly arrested and he was placed in jail. So fortunately, after numerous people came to his defense pointing out the absurdity of a Jew working to help the Germans in their war efforts, he was eventually released from bail and went on to live a beautiful life. But there is something that amazes me about this story. When Jewish people see a wig, they see holiness, they see sanctity, they see the beckoning of Sinai for us to focus on our inner royalty and not our outer physicality. But when a non-Jew sees a shaitel, it strikes him as so bizarre, so unusual that a woman would cover her hair, so odd that a woman would choose to hide such an attractive feature, that the only possible explanation they could come up with is that that person must be a spy. We are a people who stood at Har Sinai and underwent a metamorphosis. A people who possess special cells which are inheritable. We are biologically different than the rest. We are a people who bridge heaven and earth. We are a people who have a spark inside of us that no matter what and no matter when will forever shine bright. Adolf Hitler couldn't have been more right when he said, Judaism is not a religion, it's a race. True, we are a race. One that contains unimaginable holiness. Because we don't just think different, we are different.